Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. After 16 years on death row, Scott Peterson is returning to court this morning to be resentenced in the 2002 murder of his wife, Lacey Peterson, and their unborn son, Connor. The hearing today is a result of Peterson's death sentence being overturned and reduced to life without parole. This also might be the first time Scott Peterson speaks in court about the murders nearly two decades ago. Joining us to walk through what's happening is KCRA News anchor Edie Lambert, who covered this trial gavel to gavel. Edie, welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
Well, the names Scott and Lacey Peterson are cemented in infamous, heinous crimes. But let's start from the beginning as a reporter at KCRA. What do you remember about that first tip or that first pitch in the newsroom, which ultimately led you to an assignment spanning years?
What I remember about the beginning of the trial was just the drama of a very pregnant woman being missing on Christmas Eve and the urgent search for her. It just seemed so strange and so horrible for this person to be missing. And then as Scott Peterson was looking more and more guilty, it was clear that he was coming under suspicion by the detectives in the case. I think that it led to this national fascination of how could this happen from the person you most trust, your own husband. And if Lacey didn't know Scott, do any of us know those around us? I think that's part of what led to the national fascination in this case.
And although now these names are widely known, I mean, some people may need a refresher about what exactly happened to Lacey Peterson, who was pregnant with their son at the time. I mean, this was nearly two decades ago.
You know, to that point, Vicky, I covered this gavel to gavel, as you mentioned, for KCRA and for MSNBC. I was on the air almost every single day, and I still have to go back and refresh myself on the details of the case. So yeah, it was a long time ago. The bottom line was that Lacey was 7.5 months pregnant. She disappeared on Christmas Eve. Scott Peterson had told some friends that he was planning to go golfing. And she disappeared. He later said he had gone fishing in the San Francisco Bay. And almost immediately, the detectives began suspecting him. He started acting suspiciously, no longer cooperating with investigators, sold Lacey's car, for instance, added porn channels to the lineup on his television. All of these things detectives said were basically what they called cognizance of guilt. He was acting guilty. He was acting as if Lacey was not going to come home. And it was months later that first, Connor Peterson, Lacey's baby, the fetus, washed ashore in the San Francisco Bay. And a day later, or hours later, Lacey's body was found. And it turns out that a mother's body is designed to protect the baby. And so Lacey's remains had we're in horrible shape by the time it washed ashore, but the baby had been protected in the uterus, and Connor was protected. His body was protected until almost when he washed ashore. But it was clear that he had died when his mother died, when he was 7.5 months along. At that point, when the bodies were found, detectives closed in on Scott. He was in the San Diego area at Torrey Pines Golf Course. By that time, he had dyed his hair. When they found him in his car was packed with things, clothing, thousands of dollars in cash, his own ID and his brother's ID, Viagra pills. And so investigators theorized that he was planning to cross the border into Mexico, trying to escape as he felt things were closing in as the bodies were found.
Yeah, and since then, he was obviously convicted. He was sentenced to death. Are you surprised that we're going to be returning back to court today and that this death penalty was overturned?
You know, Vicki, I am and I'm not. Judge Alfred DeLucchi, the original judge in this case, so highly respected. He was brought out of retirement to handle this very high-profile case. He had handled 20 death penalty cases. I think he'd had one reversal up until now in his entire career. And there were so many court watchers observing the whole process, including voir dire as the jury was selected. So this particular issue does surprise me. The California Supreme Court flat out said that Judge DeLucchi made a mistake in the jury selection process. It surprises me that he would make a mistake that they said was pretty obvious. But at the same time, Judge DeLucchi did say, he called this case a, quote, petri dish of appellate issues. He fully expected that there would be, you know, all kinds of issues as this was appealed, which all death penalty cases are. So I guess the answer is yes and no here.
Yeah. And this doesn't change the conviction or the guilt. But you started off by saying, you know, maybe Lacey didn't know who Scott was, or did anyone know who Scott was? When you were sitting in court, reporting or reading the report is one thing, covering the trial, sitting there, getting a front row seat, were you able to get some glimpses of who this person was?
You know, Vicki, not until the very end. You know, Scott did not testify on his own behalf, and he did not speak at his sentencing. But his family spoke on his behalf. And as you know, during the penalty phase, you will hear from the victims making victim impact statements. And I have to tell you, when Lacey's mother spoke, everyone in that courtroom, including the bailiffs, were in tears. It was so powerful and so painful. And one thing that she kept saying was divorce was an option. And when I heard from Scott's family, it made me wonder if he felt that was true. And I'll give you just a little bit of background. His siblings, so his parents had six children separately, and Scott was their only child together. And his step-siblings all testified that he was just this perfect child, this smiley little boy, always in a good mood, just a perfect, perfect child. And when Scott's mother testified, she testified about this just horrific childhood she had had, where her father was murdered, her mom had a nervous breakdown, and she ended up taking care of her siblings the best that she could. And then she had other babies before Scott. A couple of them she gave up for adoption. She raised another boy before Scott on her own until she married Lee Peterson. It was this very, very, very kind of sad beginning of her life. And her life changed when she married Lee Peterson. All of a sudden, she was cared for and loved, and they had this baby, and you could see that she was going to make sure that Scott had this perfect life that she didn't get. And I think that for Scott, he may have believed divorce was not an option because it would have made him look like a jerk with leaving a pregnant wife. It really may not have felt like an option to him.
Yeah. And he had extramarital affairs as well.
He did. That's part of what helped convict him in this case. But apparently he had had two extramarital affairs, at least two, before Amber Fry, which we, you know, obviously heard about that affair during the trial. So he met Amber while Lacey was pregnant, told Amber that he was single, and in fact, told her that his wife died and this was going to be his first Christmas without her. So that evidence obviously came into play. And something else, Vicki, that I will never forget is what once Amber Fry figured out who this guy really was, she worked with detectives and she recorded their phone calls. Scott had no idea that she knew. So he was still pretending like everything was fine while the search was on for the wife that he killed. And the detectives played a recording of Scott telling Amber that he was in Paris for New Year's Eve, and they were partying with a friend named Pasquale, and they were out in the streets, and there was lots of activity, and he was just making this whole thing up. He was on the phone at a candlelight vigil for Lacey.
Wow.
And they had a photo up in the courtroom of Scott on the phone. You can see people behind him holding candles. And that was the phone call that he was on, telling his mistress that he was out of town. So you could really see the case shift in court when Amber Fry came in to testify. And that was toward the middle of the case.
Yeah, I can imagine. Wow. Scott didn't speak during his last sentencing, but he might make a statement today. If so, what are you interested in hearing?
Oh, that's such a great question. I mean, he has maintained his innocence this whole time, and his attorneys are still fighting for an entirely new trial. They say that they have new evidence that will exonerate him if he's granted that new trial. So I don't expect that we will hear, you know, any kind of culpability. It's such a great question. I don't really know what I would hope to hear, or I would expect him perhaps to maintain his innocence.
Yeah. Before we let you go, Edie, I mean, although the outcome today won't be a surprise, is this going to be, I guess, given that, is this just kind of going to be a straightforward process today?
Yes. So the, as you mentioned, Vicky, the Supreme Court never said he didn't kill his wife. In fact, they upheld the evidence in this case, and they said the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming that he is guilty. That what happened here was a technicality in the jury selection process that has changed the death penalty only. And it was the prosecutors who decided not to retry the penalty phase and just to say, okay, fine, we'll just leave it at life without parole. So we know that the sentence will be life without parole. What is, I think, probably the emotion here is that we expect we'll hear either directly or with statements from Lacey Peterson's family. Her father has passed away, but from her mother, her brother, her sister, who, you know, still are grieving this loss. You know, Vicki, Connor Peterson, the baby, Lacey's baby, Lacey and Scott's baby, would have been 18 years old right now. And so they will certainly will hear about that loss. And we may hear about, you know, from Scott's family, his half-sister Janie Peterson has been solidly fighting for him this whole time. And again, if we hear from Scott himself, that would be a first.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Edie, for joining us.
My pleasure.
That is KCRA news anchor Edie Lambert, who covered the Scott Peterson murder trial from start to finish nearly two decades ago. Up next, imagine a winter without snow in the Sierra. A new study says we are headed in that direction, but not everyone is convinced it's a catastrophe. We'll explain. Plus, teaching the impact of climate change to students, why money, lobbying, and politics are creating mixed messages in classrooms. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The weather is starting to change finally. We've seen some small amounts of rain, temperatures have dipped, and it's starting ever so slightly to feel like winter. Checking the forecast, it appears we might be in for some more throughout the week, including desperately needed snow in the Sierra. Remember that late October storm several weeks ago? It was a great start to the rain and snow season, but if you've been to Tahoe lately, the mountains are bare. And this season, like the past several seasons before, underscores the deep concern about the impact of climate change on California, specifically our water supply. A new report published by the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory warns of no snow winters in the near future if greenhouse emissions go unchecked. Joining us now to discuss the report and the implications is Jeffrey Mount, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center and Founding Director of the Center of Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Good morning to you, Vicki.
Well, before we dig into the report from UC Berkeley, let's get an update on where we are this year so far in terms of rain and snow. I imagine it's not looking good.
Well, you have to remember, at any moment in time, you're really looking at the cumulative effect of what happened in the past. And so, as you well know, last year, the last water year, which ends September 30th, was the third driest on record. And our reservoirs are at near record, certainly north of the Delta, are at near record lows as well. So pretty grim. That wonderful Noachian deluge we had in October, which was such a surprise, it helped. It really did help because it wetted up the soils, and there wasn't a lot of runoff from it because everything was so bone dry. So we're still in dire straits. And yes, I agree with you. Next week looks great. Those of us who are looking out over the horizon all the time, we're pretty excited by it. But I remind you that our primary water management strategy is hope. And that's about all we've got.
I remember covering snow surveys up at Phillips Station along Highway 50 for many years and many months, and they just really underscore the importance of snowpack for water supply. Can you remind us how important currently snowpack is to California's water supply?
Yeah, it is important. It's about 30% of our supply, our average supply, is tied up in snowpack. So that, you know, and that's a big number because snowpack's so useful because it's released about the time it stops raining. So come April 1st, we usually have the snowpack starts to melt. And at just about that time, we dial back the amount of precipitation we're going to get. And it also comes right when some of our demands are the highest, and irrigation in particular. Irrigation demands are particularly high in the spring. That's when we start our irrigation season. So the timing of snowmelt is terrific. That's the first thing to remember. And the second is, you know, we've got 150 years of history here where we've been kind of tracking it. And our entire water supply system, particularly in the Central Valley, is built around that reliable release of water starting April 1st. And it's clearly becoming less reliable.
That brings me to the report from UC Berkeley. I mean, the headline was a low to no snow future and its impacts on water resources in the western United States. And bottom line, the report says if greenhouse emissions are not controlled, Sierra snowpack could start to disappear in the next 25 years. That is not a lot of time. And although you weren't part of the research, you have a lot of context to add. What stands out to you about this report?
A couple of things about that report. First of all, there was nothing new in it. I mean, pretty much everything they said we knew. What they did a really good job of is putting it into the context, the total context of what happens as snow declines. The only thing they probably didn't say strongly enough is we continue to think of this as something that's out there in the future, an existential threat in the future. No. It's here. We're actually seeing these changes real time. We're seeing a decline in what they call snow water equivalent, which is the amount of water that's tied up in the snow. And in particular, the last 20 years, 22 years or so, have been really, it looks like what we thought the future was going to look like. So that's the other thing is that, you know, this is not something to worry about in the future. It's something to worry about now. Now, let me give you, though, I think the important thing is that the headlines were from the Washington Post, to the New York Times, the LA Times, all over the place.
Oh, yeah. It went national, too.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and the Guardian. They were all kind of classic hair on fire headlines. The world is coming to an end. And in water, it's unless it's a flood, the disaster is usually overstated. Let me rephrase that. Unless it's a flood or we're literally cutting off water to people, it's usually overstated. It's usually a much more nuanced response to these things. And so, I mean, and you and I can talk about that this morning. There are an array of adaptations that we can use to deal with this declining snowpack. So it is, I just want to make it perfectly clear, California is not going to dry out and blow away if our snowpack is decreasing. Also, we will have plenty of snowy years in the future. We're just going to have less of them.
Yeah. And when you talk about adaptations, I mean, obviously the state and water managers and water infrastructure needs to evolve. So are reservoirs becoming outdated? I mean, I think about the reservoirs throughout the state, even aqueducts. I mean, what are some solutions we can apply to what's changing in the Sierra?
Okay, that's a really good point. And that's the place that people are focused on most right now, although there's going to be a second side to that, which is this overall concept of storage. If we are shifting our runoff, a chunk of our runoff away from springtime to winter, and that is because it's falling as rain rather than snow, well, our most important tool in water management is our reservoirs, the 1,500 reservoirs that we have, which are basically, they can capture and control about an equal amount of water we use in an average year. So it's a big deal. Our reservoirs are really important, not to mention the fact that we have a drought every year, literally from May to October, we have a drought. And without these reservoirs, it would be really difficult. But here's the problem that folks are grappling with. Our big reservoirs, we have 1,500 of them, but 10 of them account for about half our total storage, and they're all principally here in the Central Valley. But all of those reservoirs are what are called multi-purpose reservoirs. They're not just a water supply feature. They're also a flood control feature and a hydropower feature and recreation. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, we're using them to keep fish alive, salmon alive. So they're multi-purpose reservoirs. So how you balance these various purposes is going to be tricky. And the crux of the matter that people are grappling with is we know we're going to get, we are in fact getting more runoff in the winter than we did in the spring. But yet we need to leave space in our reservoirs for floods. Right out your back door in Folsom, I don't know if you were around in 1986, I was, and we came within minutes of having a big disaster. And so you had to start making more space in that reservoir. But that is a problem. What are you going to do? How are you going to capture that water that runs off in the winter if you have to leave space for flood control?
Right. And there's a lot of competing interests as well when it comes to water. I think anytime we do a water segment, we get listener emails. And it's understandable. I mean, it's very nuanced. Another issue that we want to bring up is water allocations to farmers this year. There was another headline. Department of Water Resources announced that its first allotment of water will focus on prioritizing health and safety needs. But what does that mean? I mean, are farmers not going to get any water this year?
Yeah, so there's another hair on fire headline. The State Water Project announced 0% allocations. Okay, well, in reality, that's not the case. They're going to release at least 300,000 acre feet. That's about the amount of water that's behind Folsom right now, for the health and safety needs. And specifically, it's going to go to communities that are really dependent on the State Water Project, which is run by DWR. So there will be water there. And then there's the other part is, the farmers are going to get no water. Well, that's also not true. There are a lot of farmers who receive water from the State Water Project who have senior water rights. I mean, they had water rights that pre-existed the construction of Oroville, for example. So they're going to get some of their water, probably not all, but they're going to get some too. So as usual, the only true black and white in water is that that nothing is black and white.
Right.
So, there's going to be some water. And I remind you that most of the farmers who receive water from our big reservoir systems receive it from the Central Valley Project, which is run by the federal government. And they have not released what their projections are at this point.
Before we let you go, what are some behaviors or changes that we can do right now, either as individuals, whether you're living in a city or in a rural area, or even communities to help mitigate this issue, especially if, we have, once again, a dry winter, following a dry winter the previous season.
Well, so we just saw, that's the other headline that came out last Friday, I think it was, that that the State Water Resources Control Board is going to set penalties for waste and unreasonable use of water. So that you could just be much more careful with your water use. I remind all your listeners that one half of the water use in the Sacramento area, actually more than a half of the water use in the Sacramento area, is outdoor irrigation. I mean, Jerry Brown, he was really a great water governor because he was so plain spoken about it. I kept expecting his motto to be "kill your lawn." It used to be "kill your television, kill your lawn." So there are many things. We have lots of room to adapt and adjust in our water use in the cities. And by the way, for all those headlines that said we are not conserving water, well, they just released the data for October, and Californians are using 13% less water than they used a year ago in October. So we are making a difference here. So yeah, conservation is really important to get through, at least in the short term, droughts. But the other thing is to be constantly badgering, that's not the right word, constantly contacting your representatives to get on top of planning for this drier future with less snow.
Well, it's nice to hear that there is a culture shift when it comes to water use across the state. Geoffrey, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Geoffrey Mount is a senior fellow at the PPIC Water Policy Center and founding director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Politics, money, ideology, it can be a toxic mix. Our next guest argues it's putting American school children at risk of not fully understanding the gravity that is climate change. Katie Wirth is an award-winning investigative journalist who writes about the connection between science and politics. She grew up in Chico, just miles from the Camp Fire, the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California history. Katie returned to her old middle school to report for her new book, Miseducation: How Climate Change is Taught in America. And she tells some fascinating stories about how some people in the Chico area still feel about climate change. She also shares some pretty wild stories from other classrooms around the country as well. Katie joins us now. It's a pleasure. Welcome you to Insight.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm just curious, right off the bat, what got you interested in writing about the intersection of money, politics, influence, and power? And how did it ultimately lead you to this topic of climate change and the way it's being taught in classrooms?
I've always found climate denialism fascinating because it didn't get here by accident. It didn't arise spontaneously because the science has always been very clear on this issue. And yet, you know, we live in a world where one party in our two-party system is really attached to this idea that, you know, the science is bad, that that climate change isn't actually happening, that we don't know why, things that are very that have no real basis in reality. And how that came to be is a really interesting story that we know because of some really great investigative journalism over the last several years. And then, you know, as I was reporting on climate change and, you know, in some other contexts, I realized that kids were also receiving these climate denial messages. And that just kind of got me in my tummy because, of course, kids have the most at stake. You know, they're going to be living through this century that's defined by this issue, as your previous guest was just describing.
Yeah. I mean, you reviewed dozens of textbooks, traveled all over the country, including back to the Chico Paradise area, to talk to kids about what they have learned or what they're learning about climate change. What were some of your biggest takeaways about what's going on?
Well, one big takeaway was that there's just a lot of tension over this issue in classrooms. Like I was in dozens of classrooms and I didn't find one where there wasn't some point of friction over climate change and how it was taught, whether that was between teachers and students, between parents, administrators. People have really big feelings about this issue on both sides. And so it, teachers have a lot to navigate when they teach a climate unit.
Yeah. When you headed back to your alma mater, Chico Junior High School, what did you learn? And can you share some of these anecdotes about, you know, students who go from one class to another and are getting taught completely different things about climate change?
Yeah, so I was doing some reporting in my hometown and I decided to go to my alma mater and I reached out to the science teachers there just to see what they were teaching their students about climate change. And I spoke to one sixth grade science teacher who makes a point to teach a unit on it every year, which is part of her curriculum that is mandated by the state. But she also really cares about this issue. So she puts a lot of time into it, a lot of thought into how she approaches the science. And then she has the students do, you know, after learning all the science, they do solutions projects. So they learn, you know, they try and dream up ways that this problem could be addressed. And that's a really empowering thing to do for students. So not just give them the doom and gloom, but also like there are solutions to this and you can be part of it. And we need you to be part of it. You know, this empower, roll up your sleeves kind of message. So, you know, the students got really into this every single year. But one year she noticed that the students were coming in kind of grumpy and, you know, saying things like, well, why are we learning this anyway? It's not real. What are we doing? This is dumb. And she, when she got to the bottom of it, she realized that her students were leaving her science class and walking into history class, where they were being shown by their history teacher YouTube videos from a climate denial organization that was telling them climate change isn't real, that it's all a conspiracy by scientists because scientists are trying to, you know, gain power or whatever the reasoning is. And so they were, you know, getting the complete opposite message and misinformation when they walked into their history class. So, you know, this teacher, she, Kristen Del Real is her name. She's a great teacher. And she, you know, took a day to calm herself down and she went to the history teacher and said, hey, you know, these kids are 11. You know, we have to be careful when one adult there, you know, they trust says one thing and then another adult says, oh, don't worry about that, you know, and gives them totally different information. And he said, well, you know, I just want them to know both sides. And that's an insidious thought because, of course, we do want kids to know, you know, understand that there's multiple perspectives on lots of issues. But, you know, there isn't actually two sides when it comes to the science. There's not there's not a shred of evidence that anything but human activity can explain the recent warming, you know. So he finally agreed to not show those YouTube videos anymore. But in the meantime, the students were getting really mixed messages.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm hearing is like confusing dissonance, you know, just from across the hallway from one classroom to the next. You also went outside of California, and this is really interesting, and it seems like a conflict of interest. You went to a classroom in Arkansas, and there was a woman, Paige Miller, who was an oil and gas representative, talking to students in the classroom. What did you learn about that interaction?
Yeah, so one day I was in a seventh grade science classroom in Springdale, Arkansas, and in walks Paige Miller. She's a representative of the Arkansas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners, which is the state's industry association for oil and gas. And she, her whole job is to go classroom to classroom and present and give a PowerPoint presentation to science students from third grade to high school. And this PowerPoint presentation is really pushing, you know, it had some really good information about the geology mm-hmm. of the state, where you could find oil and gas, the technology used to extract it, things that students really should know. But then it also had these messages, these very pro-fossil fuel messages, and also some kind of talking points to minimize the climate crisis that's upon us.
Well, let's take a listen.
Now, if you look around this classroom and all the plastic, you all have on rubber-soled shoes. We use plastics and rubber. We've replaced a ton of glass, wood, and metal with plastics because there's such a variety of ways it can be configured. So all of these things and 1,000 more things that we use all the time are made using petroleum products. And they haven't found a substitute yet for that. So just like we get other things from our earth, we need the oil and natural gas that we get from the earth because we have so many uses for them.
All right. Did you do any follow-up after that or check in with students or the teacher after that presentation?
Yeah. I mean, the teacher was very deferential to this guest that she had invited into her classroom. And so were the students, you know, their only questions were how much might I get paid if I worked on an offshore oil rig? And she said, well, it could be, you know, $100,000. And they're like, wow, you know, so they walked away with this very positive view of the fossil fuel industry. And if that view was counterbalanced with another guest who was from the wind industry, you know, like from Sierra Club, from a scientist who was talking about, you know, what the actual impact of using fossil fuels endlessly, indiscriminately might be, that might be part of a whole well-rounded education, but that's not the case. They were just getting this one message, and it was from directly from the fossil fuel industry. And they walked out of that class with a very rosy picture of the industry.
Did you run up against any kind of tense moments or even conflicts with teachers or parents or, I mean, as you were doing this investigative work?
Yeah, I mean, all over the place. You know, students, I remember, so one of the origin stories of this book is that I was a reporter at the PBS investigative series Frontline for several years. And I was assigned a story to, I was assigned this project where we went to the Marshall Islands and did a story about climate change there. And, you know, for those who don't know, Marshall Islands is this Pacific island nation. It's very low lying. So the highest point on these islands is 12 feet. So as you can imagine, yeah, even a foot or two of sea level rise can existentially endanger their nation, right? So we were there and we started talking to kids, and so many of them knew so much about climate change, right? So like they could talk about what was causing it, what the impacts would be, what it might mean for their life, which is more than most adults that I know can say. So one of the kids' families, they were thinking about moving to Oklahoma where they had, where there's kind of a small Marshallese community. And the question arose, well, what would their kids learn about climate change if they lived in Oklahoma? So I went to Oklahoma to find out, and I met, you know, five kids with the Islander Club whose families had come from the Marshall Islands. And four of those five told me that I was the first adult to ever say the words climate change to them on school grounds.
Wow. Before we let you go, Katie, I mean, this is, it's fascinating. I wonder if there's a silver lining to this. If we reach out to you 5 years from now for a follow-up on your reporting, what do you hope to see happen by then?
Well, you know, I think that there's it's not people recognize that climate change is happening. Even conservatives do. In the surveys, you can tell that they, you know, anyone who's kind of paying attention to the world around them and their land knows that something is up. The snowpack in the Sierras, for example, and so there's going to be, you know, there was a long time when there was a, you know, people were disagreeing over whether cigarettes cause cancer. And that was, you know, that's, at some point you could no longer make that argument, right? And there's going to come a moment when you can no longer make the argument that climate change is not caused by humans. It's just going to, the evidence is just going to be too overwhelming. So I don't know if that will happen within the next 5 years, but regardless, I really hope that, students everywhere get some information about, you know, that will are armed with information about what their future may look like.
Katie, thanks for joining us.
I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And that is investigative journalist Katie Wirth discussing her recent Washington Post Outlook cover story about how climate change is taught in American primary and secondary schools. The piece is based off of her new book, Miseducation: How Climate Change is Taught in America. You can find links to both right now on the Insight page at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Every year, just after Thanksgiving, many people, radio station stores, playing holiday music. Now, for those who love it, it's really no big deal. But for people who maybe work in retail or just don't enjoy the holidays, it can be a pain. So here to bring us some alternative holiday music beyond We Wish You a Merry Christmas, Jingle Bells, is CAP Radio's weekend host for news and modern music, Andrew Garcia. Andrew, thanks for making the trip down the hallway. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, Vicky. Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Before we get to listening, I mean, you curated this playlist that we're going to hear. Can you tell us a little bit about how you categorize the music that we're about to listen to?
Yeah, well, I did some extensive research, and for me, I found about four levels of what I'm calling holiday or Christmas music fatigue, you know, ranging from just wanting to see what's out there, trying something new, to maybe starting to feel a bit like a Grinch all the way on the other level. So it kind of ebbs and flows, I think, every year for most folks.
All right, well, let's get to that simmer. Level one, what mm-hmm. do you have for us?
Well, we've got Christmas Is Going to the Dogs by Eels, which is a very fun song. If anyone's familiar with the hipster holiday playlists on a lot of streaming platforms, they're probably familiar with this. It's, you know, not quite a classic, but traditional to some. It's people wanting to try something new, but still go with something that's a bit of a time-tested classic at this point. Let's give it a listen.
All right, so what I'm getting from this is like, all right, you're going to go to the holiday party, you know, you're going to go see your family, but maybe you don't have the tree, you know, you don't, or whatever mm-hmm. holiday season it is, because there's dozens this month. So what if you are kind, let's turn it up a little more than a simmer. What is the next level of frustration with the holidays?
Well, the next level is you're pretty tired of what's out there, all the classics, and you're pushing it so far to where you really want to break out of the box, maybe even go a little bit avant-garde with it. And so we're going with Mr. Frosty Man, Sufjan Stevens. Sufjan Stevens is known in the indie sphere of creating some really beautiful sort of Christmas music in the similar vein of like classics like Silent Night. But as we'll hear in this one, this one's a bit off kilter. Let's give it a listen. It's time to tango with the frisky, frosty, frosty man. He's got a temperature of negative degrees again. He likes ice cream and you'll tango with the jam and pants. All right, this is definitely more of an alternative vibe, you know, and maybe some passive aggressiveness towards Jack Frost or Frosty the Snowman. It's a smidge, you know, going back to the holiday party, you want your guests to dance, but you want them to be really confused the whole time through. Yeah.
The next one, I love this title, Heartbreak for Christmas. Can you just kind of unpack literally why you chose this as level three of holiday frustration?
Yes. So much like the five stages of grief, within the four levels of holiday music fatigue, there's a depression stage. And so maybe you're a retail worker, maybe you've heard Wonderful Christmas Time by Paul McCartney 10 times today, and you really just need to drown your sorrows in some old school R&B. And that's what this one is, Heartbreak for Christmas from Kelly Finnegan. Really great song.
Oh, I love this one.
It's a great song. It's just a really good song that you can listen anytime. It came out in 2019, but it sounds like it came out in the 1960s.
Yeah, it really does.
Really good. Similar to some Leon Bridges sort of vibes, taking some old school sounds and bringing it into the new.
Yeah. Maybe you're going to the ugly sweater party, but you're not partaking in the ugly sweater. It's like a little bit of a protest.
Yeah, you're taking a stance.
Yeah, you know? you're
bringing
a
heartbreak
stance
to Christmas because yes. You're tired of the songs.
Level four, this is Full Throttle. You're just Grinch level song. What is this one called?
Yes, dreaded level four. This is if you're really feeling the fatigue. And this is Sympathy for the Grinch by the band 100 Gex. And of course, a play on the classic Rolling Stones song, Sympathy for the Devil. It's a lot of fun. It's definitely really out there. Let's give it a quick listen.
I'm envisioning, you know, kind of moshing and destroying some ornaments or holiday decorations at this point.
Yes, yeah, you're sort of dancing around. It's got some ska vibes. 100 Gex, as you can hear, didn't get what they wanted for Christmas, and now they're very upset. Later in the song, they take on a heist on Santa Claus.
Oh.
So this is really serious stuff. There's some rough and tumble language in this song, so only use if in a dire situation. You really need to reset your Christmas ears and get a new appreciation for the classics.
Yeah, it's a very fun bass line and obvious little bit animosity, anger towards, you know, the holiday season.
Yeah, it's definitely coming out in some waves there. You know, I love the holidays, but sometimes, you know, it can be a little too much. So if that's you right now, this song is for you.
Yeah, and you can still have some fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
If now you mentioned you're kind of into the holidays, what is your favorite holiday song?
Ooh, that's very tough. You could go very classic and go Silent Night. That's one I loved a bunch as a kid. As far as anything else like that, I don't know. You've sort of stumped me on that one.
I kind of go back to, I guess it's kind of a curveball. Like, I like, you know, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas, but I also like The Grinch and Adam Sandler's Hanukkah song.
All I Want for Christmas is a great one. It's sort of the most recent song to be added into the holiday classics. It's like a tradition at this point, which is kind of funny. It's only 30 years old compared to a lot of these other songs that are like pushing 60 at this point.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Are you on any of these levels right now, though?
Having listened to all these songs on repeat, I might be level 5 by now after this segment, but we'll see.
We'll bring you on next week.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks, Vicky.
That is Andrew Garcia, Cap Radio's weekend host for news and modern music. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's Chief Content Officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. In the meantime, we're going to listen to Eels' Christmas is Going to the Dogs.
Good, it's true. So I'll just lay here and chew. When I sleep, I like to dream of rabbits in the snow, jumping right into my jaws from their rabbit hole. Take one home and set him down right next to your shoes. Wake up to a big surprise, my gift to you. And Christmas is going to the dogs. Rather have two toys than you lost. And things aren't looking very good, it's true. So I'll just lay here and chew.
just lay here and chew. So I'll just stay here.